This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. My name is Reyes Bertolin. I'm your host today for the New Books Network. And with me, we have Professor Kelly Olson from the University of Western Ontario. Now it's known as Western University. And Professor Olson is a specialist in Roman social history. She's interested in the areas of society and culture, especially in women, family, sexuality, clothing, and appearing. And today she is here to talk to us about one of her books. She has written two books and edited three others, as well as numerous articles on issues of clothing and appearance in the Roman world. Her first book was Dress and the Roman Woman, Self-Presentation and Society, that appeared in 2008 by Routledge. Her next book, which is the one that we are going to talk about today, is called Masculinity and Dress in Roman Antiquity, also published by Routledge in 2017. And she has just finished editing three books. One of them is called Dress and Religion in the Mediterranean Antiquity. That was published in 2021 by Bloomsbury Academic. And she has two forthcoming books, A Cultural History of Luxury, Volume 1, and A Cultural History of Beauty, also forthcoming, hopefully for this year, 2022. And so as you see, Dr. Olson is, and especially in issues like beauty, dress, appearance, and let's us start. Welcome, Kelly. Thank you very much.
Hi, Reyes. Thank you so much for having me. It's so great to be here and to be talking to you.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. So why don't we start first with some general questions about how you got this interest in Roman clothing? What motivated you to study the clothing in ancient Rome?
Well, this was my dissertation was on women's dress in the ancient world. And I guess it grew out of my own interest in fashion. So I'd always been interested in clothing and fashion and dress, really of all periods. And in addition to my research on ancient dress, I also teach for our Department of Women's Studies classes on gender and fashion, which have nothing to do with antiquity. So we start at the medieval period and we go up until like 2022. So I have just this kind of all-encompassing interest in fashion history and dress. And so back when I was a graduate student at Chicago in the early 90s, I went to my potential supervisor and I said, I want to write my dissertation on women's dress. And, you know, this was Richard Saller, and, you know, to give him all credit where credit is due, he said, yeah, sounds good. And then he paused and he said, is there going to be enough evidence? And I said, oh yeah, there's going to be enough evidence. And so I was off. So really it sort of grew out of my longstanding love of fashion and fashion history in all periods, really.
Wonderful, wonderful. It's great that you can combine your own interest with the study of antiquity.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, so when we think about Roman clothing, it seems to be very codified, no, by social rank, by age. I mean, is that impression true? And why was it so important for the Romans to distinguish themselves by their clothing?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And it does seem at first glance like Roman clothing is very codified, and a lot of it is. However, there are pieces of clothing which are genderless, ageless, and rankless. So if you think of the tunic, for instance, which everybody wears in varying lengths, right? So if you're a woman, you wear a tunic to the ground. And if you're a centurion, you wear it sort of mid-thigh, or if you're a slave, you wear it mid-thigh. And the tunic is just that, it sort of looks like a sleeveless dress. And everybody will know the tunic from Hollywood movies, I would assume. So that's a great example of a piece of clothing which really crosses all gender and rank categories. Cloaks as well are another item which everybody wears at all levels. Now, of course, there are ways in which to make pieces of clothing which cross lines of class and rank, you know, to display status. So if you have a cloak and you're a wealthy person, you don't have a cloak which is made of sort of rough brown homespun. You probably have a cloak of white linen with gold embroidery or purple stripes or what have you. So there's ways to make them, those pieces of clothing, you know, show your status. And I think the reason the Romans were so, well, you know, I don't know. I saw this on your list of questions and I've been thinking about it for days. I'm like, yeah, why were the Romans so concerned about showing their rank and their status through their dress? I mean, I suppose you could say, which is kind of the easy way out, you could say that it's human nature. So, you know, most Western cultures, I think, are kind of obsessed with their appearance and telling the story of who they are through their dress, right? Even today, I think, you know, our society as a whole is very much concerned with appearance and self-presentation. And the Romans were really no exception, I suppose. The other thing we have to remember, I guess, is that the Romans were not a card-carrying society. So there is no way for you to prove your status as a senator or an equestrian except through your dress. You don't have a little certificate that says, hi, I'm a senator, or a little card or a driver's license or a passport or anything. So it's really through your dress that people know who you are, right? And Roman dress can say so many things about the wearer. It can talk about your gender, your age, your rank, your status, your citizenship, your non-citizenship, your status as slave or free. It just says so many things about you in a way that I guess modern dress really, really doesn't anymore. So the Romans are quite conscious of their status, because I think visualizing that status is one of the few ways that they're able to, you know, tell the story of who they are. And the real dividing line in Roman society is not gendered. It's not a gender divide. So the real dividing line between, you know, between various Romans is not, are you a male or are you a female? It's, are you a slave or are you a free person? That's the huge dividing line. And so And the problem is, I suppose, or the interesting thing is that because Roman slavery is not racially grounded in the way that, you know, American Southern slavery is racially grounded, it often must have been difficult to tell walking down the street who was a slave and who was a free citizen. If you're a free poor citizen, you may not own a toga. They're quite expensive and they're hard to care for and they're hot and, you know, all the rest of it. So you might just be wearing a tunic, just like your slave neighbor, for instance. So I think in many cases, Romans who can differentiate themselves from slaves are very careful to do so in sort of great detail. So that's my very long-winded answer to why the Roman clothing is so codified. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. Yeah, I never thought in those terms of the Romans. Yeah, of course you think, you know, they had slaves, but it's, yeah, I guess it would be hard to distinguish down the road who is who, no? So did the clothing make the man then? Because, I mean, your book is about masculinity and ideas of men, of manhood.
Yeah, I think it, well, I think it does. I mean, as again, in many Western cultures, clothing is intimately connected with masculinity. Although clothing also has a kind of fraught relationship with masculinity. So, you know, just like today, in ancient Rome, there are certain kinds of things which men were not supposed to wear, or if they did wear them, then their masculinity was like kind of suspect. So men in antiquity are not supposed to wear color, right? The rainbow portion of clothing was left to women. So women in ancient Rome are the ones that wear pink and yellow and green and, you know, light gray and other colors like that. And Roman males are supposed to wear undyed wool. So I guess in some cases that could be white. It could also be off-white or beige or brown or a dark color. So it's interesting if you look at the male relationship to color and ornament through the centuries. You know, they're in ancient times, they're really, men are not supposed to dress colorfully. And that changes very slowly, starting in the early modern period. And by the late 18th century, in Europe, certainly men are just as adorned with lace and silk and gold embroidery and pink and pale pastel colors as women are. And then in the first few decades of the 19th century, comes what scholars call the great male sartorial renunciation, where men just decide, apparently collectively, that they're not going to wear color anymore. And so, you know, somber black and brown for men really begins around 1840 or 1850 or so. And once again, the greater part of the rainbow is left to women. So we see a very similar thing happening in ancient Rome, where men just don't wear color. The exceptions are purple, which is the status color par excellence because it's so expensive to produce. So men can wear that in small amounts. You can't go around dressed entirely in purple because that, of course, makes you look like you want to be a monarch. And the Romans have a horror, at least until the empire, they have a horror of the word king. So you don't want to do that. And interestingly, the other color that men could wear and not be seen as effeminate was scarlet, because that's also a very expensive color. It comes from, we would call it cochineal. So it's the red that comes from the eggs of the insect. Also very expensive to produce. So scarlet and purple are really the only two colors that men can wear in antiquity and still be thought to be males, right? So yellow especially is very much a female color. The Roman bride had parts of her costume colored yellow. So her shoes are yellow. Her long veil is yellow. She has other yellow touches on her clothing. And yellow is a female color. It's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, but one scholar has put forward the supposition that maybe yellow was conceived of as this female color because saffron, which is the herb from which the Romans get that brilliant yellow dye, is also a medicine in antiquity and is used to treat women's ills, so menstrual cramps and I think it's like bringing on a period. Those are treated with saffron, which also yields yellow. And so that might be an odd reason why the color yellow is so, you know, sort of so strongly associated with women in the ancient Roman mind. So clothes did make the man. Color definitely did not, but I suppose clothing absolutely did. So yeah, they are not supposed to wear color. Men in antiquity don't wear makeup. Usually they envision, like the Greeks, a kind of extreme polarization of the sexes. So, you know, everything that men are or do or look like, women are the opposite. So there's a little bit of overlap. And I know that we'll eventually get around to talking about dandies and effeminacy. But this sort of upstanding Roman male, he's very much against color and ornament of any sort.
Well, like many men today still,
yes,
no? They're
right?
Like that. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
right. Yeah.
And so what type of evidence do we have for actual garments? How do we know what they wore? And what type of clothes do they have? And yeah, if you can comment on that a bit.
Yeah, it's very hard being a historian of ancient clothing, because historians of clothing in other cultures, like 18th century clothing, for instance, or Victorian clothing, can actually go into museums and look at physical pieces of clothing, right? And they can look at, evidence of wear, and, you know, they can detail how styles change by looking at actual garments themselves. And historians of ancient clothing don't have that that luxury. So we are thrown back on descriptions of clothing in literature, which is problematic. Every author has his own agenda and may or may not be reflecting what is actually going on around him. He might instead be describing an ideal world rather than, you know, reflecting what's actually happening. And then the other type of evidence that we mostly have is art. And that's also problematic. As I tell my students, art is not a snapshot of everyday life. It has its own agenda. And art always embellishes and omits and exaggerates for its own purposes. We do have some records of ancient garments. The problem is textiles and leather are very archaeologically fugitive, so they don't really stand up to the test of time, right? So there are a few sites like Vindolanda in Roman Britain where there have been like literally 5,000 shoes pulled out of the ground. So it's a really great site for leather and shoes. It's fantastic. And then Egypt is good for the preservation of textiles. But the problem is most of the textiles from Egypt are so-called Coptic textiles, which are much later than the period I study. So if you study 5th century or 6th century or 7th century CE clothing, then there are some examples from Egypt. But unfortunately, most Roman clothing really just doesn't survive. So sometimes there's like a scrap of clothing that survived at an archaeological site, or the sole of a shoe or a needle, you know, these little tantalizing glimpses of Roman sort of self-presentation. But yeah, I'm afraid most of the evidence is literary evidence and then artistic representations, for sure.
Is it enough to reconstruct? I guess it must be. You've written two books about it.
I made like an entire career on it, so I really hope so. it's very problematic because, again, even if I was a clothing historian of another century, like 18th century, even if, let's say for the sake of argument, there were no 18th century pieces of clothing left for me to look at, I would still have things like price lists and catalogs and women's diaries and women's letters and archival records of clothing and receipts for the sale of clothing and women talking about fashion in diaries or letters. And that kind of immediate historical source, that sort of archival source, is missing from the ancient world. So, you know, really what we have from the ancient world, not only is clothing in literature and art, but clothing in literature and art filtered through a particular gaze, right? So in the literature, it's obviously the male elite gaze. And to some extent in art, it's also an elite gaze because poor people can't afford to have marble statues made of themselves. So most of the art that we have from Roman antiquity naturally skews itself towards the middling and upper classes. So yeah, it is it's rather frustrating sometimes, I admit. But part of what I love about my subject is that it's not like all laid out there for me to look at. It involves a certain amount of detective work, and I have to look in all different kinds of literary sources, and I have to look at, you know, papyrological sources, and I look for evidence of, you know, those who had jobs in the appearance trades, in the epigraphy, and, you know, I have to look in a lot of different places. So it does make it very interesting and also very challenging.
Yeah. I mean, I know a little bit what you mean. I love working with fragments. It's just, yeah, so tantalizing to imagine what it could have been.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, in our society, when we think about Roman clothing, we think about the toga. You know, I mean, we have the toga parties at universities and things like that. But yeah, why do you think the toga was so symbolic in Rome? You know, you talk about in your book about how it has all this symbolic value. Can you explain us a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, the toga is what you wear on top of your tunic if you're a citizen and if you're going outside. So togas, you know, they're not attached to themselves at any point, at least not that we can not that we know. And so managing a toga, especially a toga of, say, the early empire, when they're really big, very voluminous garments, you know, it's very difficult. They're cumbersome. They're made of wool, so they're hot. They're very expensive because there's lots of material and fabric. In antiquity, it was really expensive in a way that it just isn't today. Like, the Romans don't have fabric land that you can go and buy, you know, 5 meters of light flannelette and make yourself a toga. So every piece of clothing in the ancient world is made to order, right? It's bespoke clothing, unless it's secondhand, unless there are secondhand clothing markets in Rome. So the toga is a sign of rank, but it's also a sign of status because you're the kind of man who is able to manage that huge voluminous toga while you're going about your daily business. And there are certain things that you can't do when you're wearing a toga. And one of them is like hurry, right? You can't run anywhere. And in fact, it's slaves that are characterized as the rank that hurries. Slaves are always running from place to place, doing the bidding of others. But the toga wearing male, you know, can walk very calmly from place to place because he's not at anyone's beck and call. He's under his own, you know, sort of steam. And walking slowly is one of the necessary things in order to keep that toga on. So that's a kind of interesting, I think it's a kind of an interesting side note about the toga, is that this is why it's one of the reasons it's denied to slaves, is that it's just so impractical. Like, they just can't wear it and run all over the city of Rome or do manual labor or anything like that. And for that same reason, even citizens of the lower orders who were legally entitled to wear the toga may not have owned one for all those reasons. So the expense, the maintenance, the difficulty in assuming a toga and then doing manual labor. So the toga was probably looked on by the vast majority of men in Rome as like a burden, kind of like a tie is today, you know, like how men, when they get home from work, the first thing they do is take that tie off because it's so uncomfortable. In fact, the Christian author Tertullian has this fantastic piece called On the Pallium, which is a light Greek cloak, as you know, and he has a really fantastic sort of excursus on why everyone hates the toga. And the main reason is because it's so uncomfortable to wear. It's so burdensome. But it's precisely that burden that makes it so important a marker of status, right? It tells the world that you're a kind of old-fashioned, upstanding Roman, of the severe sort, and you're not going to leave your toga off. It's because it's the respectable thing to do is to wear a toga when you leave the house. And if you don't wear a toga, then heaven forbid, you could be mistaken for a slave. And the Romans of the upper classes do not want that. So that's one of the things the toga says about them when they assume it is A, they're not a slave, and B, they're of a sufficient status in order to walk around Rome wearing this very burdensome piece of clothing. The toga can have various symbols on it in order to indicate where you are in the political hierarchy. So magistrates, those holding political office, have a border on their toga, a wide purple border. And it's one of the current controversies raging in Roman clothing studies. Is the location of that border. So some scholars hold that it was on the lower edge of the toga, the curved edge closest to the ground. That's possible. I think that's super impractical because that's the part that gets dirty, right? That's the part that drags in the dirt and gets splashed with mud and all the rest of it. And Roman clothing is very expensive to maintain. Like, it's hard to keep it clean. And the other problem with laundering your clothing is that it sort of ruins it. I mean, they don't have fabric softener back in ancient Rome, and they use a variety of very abrasive substances to get the dirt out. And every time you take your toga in, if it's got a wide purple border on it somewhere, that will fade a little bit every time you do it. And then eventually you'll have to get it re-dyed, which is very expensive. So I think personally the border was probably on the sort of loop that went across the man's chest. I think that's a much more practical location for the border on the toga. So, the other thing that the Roman male may have had, possibly, although literary sources don't mention this, are toga weights. So, you know, I guess they sort of would look like loom weights. And they're attached to the bottom hem of your toga to sort of keep it from blowing up and keeping it, you know, keep it straight and looking well. And there's no mention of them in literature, but there do seem to be toga weights on the togate figures in the Areopagus in Rome. So, and one of the things I would like to do, although so far I have been stymied by the Italian archaeological authority, is I want to get into the Areopagus Museum, and I want to look at the friezes like at eye level. Like right now they're 10 feet above the ground, and it's really hard to pick out, you know, details of clothing. But I think they're toga weights, so that's also kind of interesting. So the toga is a big symbol of status and rank because it's so hard to wear it. It's really expensive, and you know, it has a kind of weightiness which is supposed to equal your own personality as a Roman senator or a Roman magistrate.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah, no, very interesting what you said about the weights, because mm-hmm. even expensive coats now have weights.
They do. That's right. Yeah, they do. Know, like, yep, like the lining. Yeah. Huh.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
great.
And even skirts in the 50s yep. and 60s, yep. they all had the weights, too, weights yeah. to them. Yeah.
Yep. Cool.
Yeah, very interesting. In your book, you also talk about black clothes and sordid clothes. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Can you think about some modern parallels about that?
Yeah, and it was a very frustrating chapter to write, because often the Latin authors say sordid, and it can mean that the man in question is either wearing black and or is in mourning, or that he's in sordid clothing, dirtied or sullied clothing. And so it just took me ages to wrestle out all the various, tease out all the various little answers to this. But so the Romans do have black clothing, and they do wear it for mourning, but men don't mourn. So we have to make a distinction between grief, which, you know, every Roman must have felt at the death of a loved one, and formal mourning, which women seem to have assumed, but men did not assume, mourning clothing. So men wore a black toga and presumably a black tunic the day of the funeral. And then after that, they assumed their normal clothing. Women wore black clothing. If their husband had died, for instance, they wore black clothing, as far as we can tell, for 1 to 2 years. And I don't think that the mourning rules were not as complicated as they were in, say, Victorian Britain, where you have to wear this color for this long if it's a husband or a mother, and this color for this long if it's a sister, and there are various gradations of half mourning, and it's very complicated. So the Roman male does wear black as a show of mourning, but only the day of the funeral. And the black wool can be naturally occurring black wool. The Romans also have black dyes they can use. But it's not an everyday, interestingly, black is not an everyday color as far as we know. So if you saw someone in black clothing, just like in Victorian England, you would know that they had recently suffered a bereavement, right? That's very obvious. Sordid clothing is a really fascinating subject. I can't quite work out which came first, because sordid clothing is a kind of corollary of mourning. So when you are feeling grief as a Roman male, you may do things like grow your hair and beard out. You may not be wearing black clothing, but you may grow your hair and beard out. You may also not pay very close attention to your personal appearance. So your clothing might become dirty. Your person might become dirty. And this is because you're so involved in the grief for your loved one, that you neglect your personal appearance. However, that kind of appearance is also used as a political protest, which is, on the one hand. So when Cicero was exiled, a bunch of his followers decided they were not going to trim their hair or beards until he was recalled. They were not going to wash. They were not going to have their clothing laundered. And so they made a kind of political show of their unkemptness as a political protest. A sordid appearance also comes into play in a Roman court case. So if you, a Roman citizen, are on trial for his life, say you've murdered somebody or you've burnt down a temple, then the normal thing to do was appear as if you're in mourning. And your friends and family show up to the court case also arrayed in mourning clothing. So I assume the women wear black, although we're not told anything. But you, the defendant, and your friends and family all show up like dirty and disheveled. You know, you grow out your hair and your beard. And this is a kind of attempt to win sympathy from the jury, right? This is what will happen if you condemn this man to death. Look at his poor family. Look at his little children. Look at the man himself. Look at how abject he is and how sorry he is for his actions. I find this fascinating because today in a courtroom, the defendant is always like in a suit and shaven and he has his hair done. And like, it doesn't matter what crime he's committed, he's supposed to present as well as he can, right? He never shows up unshaven or dirty or unkempt. But for the Romans, it was really important. And in fact, if you were on trial and you didn't show up looking sordid, that really could count against you. The jury would think that you were being really arrogant and they might condemn you just because they thought you were taking the piss. So sordidness is a really kind of fascinating aspect of Roman appearance, which again, really doesn't, I can't quite think of any modern practice which a court which sort of falls into line with the Roman practice of sordid appearance as a political protest or as an appeal to a jury. And of course, modern mourning clothing, that is wearing black for a death, formal mourning, that is, sort of falls into desuetude after the 1920s. Although sometimes it's still quite common to wear black to a funeral, I think, often, but we don't go into formal mourning anymore, for sure.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, maybe on the day of the funeral. But even so, I've been to several funerals and people don't wear black anymore.
No, they don't. And sometimes there's instructions from the deceased, like, this is going to be my funeral. I'm having everybody wear pink when I die. So, like, everybody shows up in the deceased's favorite color. So, yeah, no, there's definitely no formal mourning, for sure.
Yeah, so did the Romans have some equivalent to what we would call now the metro man, you know, like the men that do really care about their appearance?
Yes, they did. And just like today, you know, certainly this is maybe not true of the younger generation, but men of my own age, like, you know, if you pay too much attention to your appearance, like, that's kind of suspect, right? Like, you know, and the Romans thought the same thing. So, for the Romans, the male, you know, the true Roman man is the one who wears, you know, the undyed clothing, the toga, you know, he's clean and neat, but he's not overly adorned, right? He doesn't wear color, for one thing. He's not supposed to wear makeup. He's not supposed to curl his hair or wear a certain kind of perfume. Men are supposed to be perfumed in the ancient world as a sign of sort of sophisticated urbanite. But, you know, there are certain behaviors which men are not supposed to indulge in because women engage in them. And yet there are, again, very tantalizing glimpses in Roman literature of what I would call Roman dandies. So they're often ridiculed and censured by Roman authors. And they are men who wear colorful clothing, who curl their hair, who wear really complicated concoctions of perfume, who like to wear silken clothing, which is, again, something which should be reserved for women. And in the past, and in fact, by the Roman authors of the time, they were condemned as canidae, which is a kind of a category which looks like a proto homosexual male identity, but it's not really, because canidae are the thing that sets canidae apart are that they've totally given up trying to appear as a man. So they wear colored clothing and they curl their hair and they wear makeup. And also they have no sexual self-control. So canidae, yes, they like to have sex with men. Most Roman men like to have sex with men, but they also like to have sex with women. They'll just have sex with anybody. They don't care. They have no sexual self-control. And so the dandy in Roman literature is often poked fun at and called a canidus. But I think the reality must have been a little more complicated than that, because plenty of men in the sources who are said to be wearing silk and colorful clothing and expensive concoctions of scent are, in fact, not canidae. They're very firmly Roman, sort of good old-fashioned Roman men. And so I suspect that, you know, for a man to show an overt interest in his own appearance in antiquity was just held to be a little suspect, the same as it is today, at least among men of a certain age. So yeah, there are definitely metrosexuals in antiquity. And, you know, through the ages, they've been called various things. So in 18th century and 19th century England, they're called dandies. And we call them metrosexuals. I'm not sure the word dandy is still current. I guess it is sometimes, but mostly we call them metrosexuals. So yeah, there are definitely men in antiquity who are very, very interested in their own appearance. And they're very interested in their own appearance, you know, because they, you know, they have a love of fine clothing and they have a love of personal adornment.
Thank you. Very interesting. Yeah. So, I mean, the topic has come up already several times about how men didn't go for the extravagant clothing other than this particular group. Why do you think that's the case, you know? But because it seems to be the case nowadays too, no? Mm-hmm.
I honestly don't know. I mean, it's just, I mean, okay, if I was being really cynical, I would say, oh, it's misogyny. So, you know, in the ancient world, you don't want to appear like a slave. That's sort of priority number one. But you also don't want to appear like a woman, because women in the ancient world are like powerless and they're weak and, you know, they're overly emotional and they can't hold political office. And they're like, you know, they're very much supposed to be anyway, very passive beings. And, you know, I think today fashion for certainly men of younger generations is changing a little bit, but it's still not at all common to walk down a street in Canada, say, and see men in skirts. That's just, the skirt is very firmly a female type of clothing, even though every once in a while a modern designer tries to reinsert the skirt as a kind of male item of fashion. And it just has never caught on. And I think it's because skirts are just so associated with women. And men don't want to take them up because I think essentially we still live in a misogynist world. So I really think that, you know, women are perfectly, it's perfectly okay for women to wear trousers and suits and ties, but it's definitely not okay for men to wear skirts or shawls or anything that will make them look like a woman, even slightly like a woman. So that's my very cynical answer, is that it's misogyny.
Yeah, sure.
When you call a man effeminate, it's as an insult. You're calling him womanly. So, you know, there it is.
Yeah. Yes. It's bad to be a woman.
It's bad to be a woman.
and I have just the last question that I thought when at the beginning of this interview you talked about Hollywood movies, and I'm like, yeah, there's lots of Hollywood movies showing Roman clothing or supposedly Roman clothing. How truthful are they? I'm sure it varies, but can you talk a little bit about
that? They're mostly, like I tell my daughters, I say they always get the clothing wrong. Like they always do. It's kind of like amazing. You can really set your watch by the fact that they get the clothing wrong. So in Gladiator, which came out in 2000, which is a movie I really love. It's a very beautiful movie. It's very evocative, but the clothing is not Roman. The clothing comes actually from the late 19th century's view of Roman clothing. So the painter Lawrence Alma Tadema, or is it Alma Tadema? He painted a series of so-called Roman paintings. And in it, he sort of came up with his own vision of Roman clothing. And that's the clothing you see in Gladiator, is Alma Tadema's vision. It's not often very accurate. Although I do tell my students that the movie which is the most visually true to ancient Rome is probably Fellini's Satyricon, which is not a popular movie with my students because it's very episodic and, you know, the music is very discordant. But visually speaking, it's like spot on. It's very, very accurate. It's really good. So yeah, so it's mostly not very, the clothing is mostly not very accurate at all. And, you know, as a clothing historian, I will always be looking to see what they do with the clothing in the Roman movie or the ancient Greek movie. But I mean, I suppose really it's more important that the clothing helps to evoke the ancient world, right? Whatever the vision of the director, screenwriter, has in mind for the ancient world, it's important that the clothing evoke that vision. So I guess it's more important that the clothing be, you know, part of the visual imagery of the movie rather than being strictly accurate. So that's what I tell myself anyway.
Yeah. To just burst my bubble thinking.
I know, I'm sorry.
Elizabeth Taylor's Cleopatra is not really how Cleopatra looked like.
I love that movie so much. And I have discussions with my fashion students because to me, it's really fascinating how in historical dramas, like the Cleopatra movies, for instance, even though it's supposed to be set in ancient Egypt, you can always tell in which decade the film was made. So Liz Taylor's Cleopatra looks very 60s and Claudette Colbert's Cleopatra looks very 30s. And Lindsay Marshall's Cleopatra from HBO's Rome looks very early 2000s. And it fascinates me how try as the costumer might, the decade in which the film is made sort of seeps through all the good intentions of making the clothes historically accurate, you can still tell in which decade the film was produced. It's really fascinating.
Mm, yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, that was a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for... Well,
thank you so much for having me. It was so fun. I love talking about Roman clothing.
Yeah, well, maybe we can keep talking at a separate occasion then.
Yeah, I'd love that.
Well, thank you very much, Kelly, and... Good night.
Okay, thanks, Reyes. Good night.